This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
This episode features discussions of violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
On the evening of September 20th, 2003, Bill Rothstein scurried down his driveway, hopped in his van, and sped away. Then he pulled out his cell phone and dialed 911.
Heart pounding, Bill explained that there was a suspicious woman at 8645 Peach Street, and there was a body inside the garage freezer.
The operator was skeptical. How would Bill know about a body at that address?
Bill responded that the house was his, and the woman inside was Marjorie Deal Armstrong. He said he had helped her do some stuff he shouldn't have, but that he'd never killed anybody. The operator said the authorities would need to question him anyway, and Bill promised to stop by the station later that night.
Little did the police know, this was the first in a chain of clues that would lead them not only to Jim Roden's dead body, but to the perpetrators behind Brian Wells' bank robbery and death.
Bill himself was a key player, but he wouldn't live to see the case unravel. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
And this is our final episode on Brian Wells, more infamously known as the Pizza Bomber. On August 28, 2003, Wells entered a PNC bank in Erie, Pennsylvania, with a letter demanding $250,000 in cash. Last week, we followed Brian through the events of the robbery, from the moment his cohorts forced him to wear an active collar bomb to his untimely death when the bomb exploded.
This week, we'll follow the investigation surrounding the case. We'll uncover an unbelievable secret about Bill Rothstein that led to his death, and we'll learn how FBI agent Jerry Clark was able to string together evidence against the remaining three conspirators.
In the months after Brian Wells' failed robbery and death, 54-year-old Marjorie Deal Armstrong and her co-conspirator, 59-year-old Bill Rothstein, scrambled to cover their tracks.
One of their first moves was to silence 43-year-old Robert Panetti, Brian's co-worker who had convinced him to take part in the plot. With the help of another accomplice, 49-year-old Ken Barnes, they slipped Robert a lethal cocktail. He was dead within hours.
Meanwhile, local authorities and the Pennsylvania FBI office were piecing together the few details they knew about Brian Wells' death. He had clearly been a hostage, and Robert Panetti's death indicated that a larger crew was at work. After all, why would two employees from the same pizza restaurant turn up dead within days of each other, unless they had been pawns in the same robbery? Then, on September 20th, investigators learned of a third body.
Bill's phone call tipped them off to the murder of Marjorie's ex-boyfriend, 45-year-old Jim Roden. Marjorie had killed him weeks before the robbery even took place. Now, his body was stashed inside a freezer in Bill's garage.
Bill and Marjorie had planned to dismember Jim's frozen body with an ice crusher and get rid of the pieces. But Bill had another scheme in mind: to serve Marjorie to the police. At 8:14 p.m., he slipped out of his house and called 911.
Bill told officials about the body in his freezer and gave them permission to search his house. But he refused to return home until he knew they had arrested Marjorie. By now, he knew better than to cross her and show his face, at least not until they were in court.
An hour later, Bill called the police again, asking if Marjorie had been apprehended. Despite having an integral role in the entire plot, Bill now played the part of a frightened accessory to Marjorie. He even told the authorities he had recently considered suicide and that he had a revolver inside his van at home. He offered to drive down to the police barracks so they could talk further.
Bill noted that as long as he wasn't read his rights, he could provide the police with information off the record. He was already crafting a deal for himself, and the police readily agreed.
Bill arrived at the police barracks around 10 p.m. and provided them with a slew of testimony incriminating Marjorie in the death of Jim Roden. Through it all, Bill was careful to say nothing implicating himself in the Brian Wells case or Robert Panetti's death. He was there to clear himself of Jim's murder, not to be incriminated in a different murder.
At 3 a.m. that night, state troopers barged into Bill's home on Peach Street. Inside, they found both Marjorie and Jim Roden's body, just as Bill had promised.
Apparently, after Bill had taken off, Marjorie was still determined to get rid of Roden's body herself. And for someone with a notorious quick temper, she didn't put up a fight. She went calmly with the arresting officers, saying nothing, except that she'd had a history of poor luck with men.
Meanwhile, FBI agent Jerry Clark awoke to a phone call telling him to report to the house next to the TV tower on Peach Street. A third body had been found.
Clark's eyes grew wide. Brian had referenced that very same TV tower in the minutes before his death. In fact, the authorities had already visited that house in the days following the bombing to ask if Bill had seen any suspicious activity. There wasn't any evidence yet directly linking this murder to the first two, but as Clark drove over to Bill's house, he couldn't help but feel it was all connected.
When they entered the house, Clark and the other investigators quickly realized that Bill was a hoarder. They had to wade through piles of junk to identify any relevant evidence, but their persistence paid off. They found the ice crusher and a revolver on the seat of a broken-down van outside.
To their surprise, they also found Bill's suicide note. Apparently, he'd been planning to take his own life before he decided to go to the police instead. It read, "Police, my body is in the bedroom on the first floor in the southeast corner of the house. 1. This has nothing to do with the Wells case. 2. The body in the freezer in the garage is Jim Roden. 3. I did not kill him, nor participate in his death."
Clark was stunned. This was the first time all night and morning that Bill had brought up Brian Wells. Why would he go out of his way to mention the Wells case in his suicide note if he wasn't involved?
Back at the police barracks, the officers pressed Marjorie for information. She declined to make a formal statement, but she did offer an interesting piece of information. Bill Rothstein had recently allowed a convicted rapist to hide out at his house. His name was Floyd Stockton.
Later that day, they traced Floyd to his girlfriend's apartment and arrested him. Floyd admitted to Clark and the other FBI agents that he had just moved out of Bill's house about 2 or 3 weeks prior. This placed him at Peach Street on the day of the robbery. However, when Floyd was questioned about his involvement in Brian Wells' death, he offered a suspicious account. Floyd claimed that at 3 p.m. on August 28th, roughly 18 minutes before Brian died, he heard a knock on the front door of Bill's house. He had looked out the window and noticed a police cruiser, and rather than answer the door, he turned on the TV to check the news.
Clark was astounded by Floyd's tale. Why would anyone turn on the news to determine why a police cruiser was parked outside of their home, unless they knew a major crime was unfolding? It seemed to him like Floyd was just shooting from the hip.
Floyd was given a lie detector test, but he somehow managed to foil it. However, Clark remained leery. He disliked polygraphs and knew they could be beaten.
As Clark would later note, experienced criminals, especially those with antisocial traits like Floyd, can easily fool lie detectors. They do this by controlling their emotions and regulating their breathing. Clark also explained that these criminals have no fear of lying and thus have a lessened physiological response to fear.
Clark suspected that Floyd was a seasoned liar and that the polygraph test was a dud. Regardless, his FBI superiors trusted the test and moved to clear Floyd as a suspect.
Floyd was still made to answer for existing rape charges and sentenced to 2 years in prison. But during that time, he would be off limits for further questioning.
While Floyd was being dealt with, Marjorie was quickly charged in the murder of Jim Roden, thanks to Bill's statements. She neither admitted nor objected to the charges against her. Instead, she continued to exercise her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination.
Bill, however, was happy to keep talking, provided he was given protection. As authorities drafted the criminal complaint against Marjorie, Brad Folk, the district attorney, agreed to give Bill consideration as long as he agreed to testify against Marjorie in court. Bill agreed.
On September 21st, the day after Jim's body was found, police officials questioned Bill for nearly 5 hours. He detailed Jim's murder and the subsequent plot to dispose of evidence. Through it all, he maintained that he had only ever assisted Marjorie because he was afraid of her.
As Clark waited his turn to interview Bill, he continued mulling over the suicide note. Why would Bill go out of his way to deny his participation in the Brian Wells case? Why would anyone be so cryptic with their final words, unless their suicide note was not really a suicide note?
Clark was beginning to suspect that Bill had planted evidence to twist the facts in his favor, and this manipulation was about to show its true colors.
The FBI deals with its fair share of narcissistic characters, but Bill was insufferable. As soon as Clark walked into the room, Bill looked up and said, "Let me get this out of the way first. I'm the smartest guy in this room."
This was just the first of many ways in which Bill would struggle to control the conversation. He refused to speak in anything but hypothetical statements, and he often turned the questioning on Clark. He was even physically demanding, constantly shifting from chair to chair, complaining that he couldn't get comfortable.
Clark, however, was unfazed, and after some preliminary questioning, he cut to the chase. He pressed Bill about the events of August 28th, the day of Brian Wells' death.
Bill had his alibi ready. He said he had picked up Marjorie at the local Walmart and spent the day with her in a nearby town before dropping her back off at Walmart that evening. When he was asked about the call he placed from the Shell station, Bill conceded that he had probably been there sometime on August 28th, since it was so close to his home. He casually mentioned that he may have even used the payphone.
At last, Agent Clark decided it was time to use Bill's arrogance against him. Clark had a master's degree in forensic psychology, and by this point, he was convinced that Bill was the type of person who believed his intellect could rescue him, no matter what. What's more, he knew that Bill couldn't resist the opportunity to prove his intelligence. And so, Clark asked him, point blank, why he thought Brian Wells wouldn't have gone straight to the police after having a bomb put around his neck.
Bill took the bait, launching into a long-winded explanation. He told Clark that the bombers may have put electrical charges in the collar to ensure that Brian would stay on his route. He said they might have even used a radio-controlled transmission to detonate the bomb. By now, Bill was on a roll, eager to show off his knowledge of explosives. He said that if he wanted to build the collar, hypothetically, of course, he would have used smokeless powder from shotgun shells.
Clark listened with suppressed satisfaction. He had successfully leveraged Bill's need to be the smartest person in the room. Now he was convinced that not only had Bill participated in the Brian Wells case, he had played the role of puppeteer, orchestrating at least the bomb, if not the entire plot.
However, just like Floyd, Bill passed his polygraph test.
Clark was especially unimpressed by this. Investigators had actually found instructions in Bill's home on how to outsmart lie detectors. And yet, despite all the evidence, Clark's FBI peers were sure that Bill was not their man. They still couldn't comprehend why someone who lived so close to the TV tower would plot a crime right there. It seemed too careless for someone like Bill, who at least attempted to think one step ahead of the police.
So far, Clark didn't have enough evidence to indict Bill in the pizza bomber case, but he wasn't completely off the hook. On October 9th, the Pennsylvania police charged Bill Rothstein with four crimes in connection to the Jim Roden murder: abuse of a corpse, conspiring to abuse a corpse, tampering with evidence, and conspiring to tamper with evidence.
Bill was released on bond and waived his right to a preliminary hearing. In accordance with his plea bargain, he went on to testify against Marjorie at her preliminary hearing.
It would be the first time in months that the two masterminds met face to face.
Coming up, Marjorie tries to get revenge on Bill.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now back to the story.
On January 20th, 2004, 5 months after Brian Wells' death, Bill Rothstein sat in the witness chair at the Erie County Courthouse. He testified that his former friend, Marjorie Deal Armstrong, had murdered her ex-boyfriend, Jim Roden. When asked why Marjorie did it, Bill said that Marjorie was upset with Jim for not having done enough to investigate a break-in at their home.
Throughout the hearing, there was no mention of Brian Wells and the pizza bomber investigation. Though Jim and Brian's murders seemed linked by geography, they were being treated as separate cases entirely.
Bill rattled on, insisting that he had nothing to do with Jim's murder, while Marjorie sat silent as a stone. Her true colors wouldn't come to light until after the hearing, when Marjorie stormed out of the courthouse, livid at how heartlessly Bill had betrayed her. Immediately, she was greeted by a swarm of reporters.
Suddenly, the path to revenge was clear. Marjorie knew what she could do to get back at Bill. She stepped up to the cameras and called Bill a filthy liar. He had committed crimes of his own.
One of them, she said, was the death of Brian Wells.
It was the worst possible blow Marjorie could have dealt Bill, but he wouldn't live to to feel the consequences.
Just a few months later, in the spring of 2004, Bill was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Bill was dying, and quite possibly, he had known all along that he was sick. If this was true, he had nothing to lose by participating in the robbery and murder. He wouldn't live to see the consequences of his actions.
What's more, he may have only incriminated Marjorie as one final act of showmanship, the grand finale of his narcissism.
Meanwhile, Marjorie's legal proceedings continued for the murder of Jim Roden. Her defense team was well aware of her struggle with bipolar disorder, and they hoped to use it to Marjorie's advantage.
On March 22, 2004, the judge granted a request for Marjorie to undergo a 6-month psychiatric review at Mayview State Hospital. This would determine whether she was mentally competent to stand trial.
The FBI was prohibited from speaking to Marjorie while she was at Mayview, an unstable mental state equated to an unreliable interview, and if they questioned her during this time, they risked the judge throwing out the statement. Without access to Marjorie, Agent Jerry Clark and his team pivoted towards other persons of interest.
They turned their attention back to Bill, whose medical secret was finally coming to light. In late July, Clark received a call from District Attorney Brad Folk, informing him that Bill was in the hospital. Clark moved to question him immediately.
Clark's own father had died from stomach cancer, and seeing the shape Bill was in, he estimated that the suspect only had a month left to live.
When Clark questioned Bill on the afternoon of July 27th, he became certain that Bill had known about his cancer prior to Brian Wells' death. It explained why Bill had seemed so pleased with himself in the interviews, why he had been willing to incriminate Marjorie in Jim's murder instead of helping her get away with it.
With Floyd Stockton in prison on rape charges and unavailable for questioning, Clark knew Bill was his last opportunity to connect the cases. But Bill's mind was foggy from the drugs he was given. His answers were vague and non-committal. And ultimately, he maintained that he hadn't been involved in the Wells case. Clark left the interview empty-handed.
It was the last time he would speak with Bill. 3 days later, on July 30th, 2004, Bill Rothstein died, taking everything he knew about Brian Wells with him.
With Bill gone, Clark could only rely on Marjorie for more pieces to the pizza bomber puzzle. Luckily, she was about to do some of the heavy lifting for him.
At Mayview, Marjorie had been treated with psychotropic drugs, sending her bipolar disorder into remission. After 6 months, the judge and the examining psychiatrist found her competent to stand trial.
On January 7, 2005, Marjorie Deal Armstrong pleaded guilty but mentally ill to 2 counts in the Jim Roden case, third-degree murder and abuse of a corpse. The presiding judge acknowledged both Marjorie's intelligence and history of psychological disorders and sentenced her to 7 to 20 years in state prison.
However, Marjorie's plea afforded her the right to continue treatment at Mayview. She was to start serving her sentence at the state hospital, where she would continue to be off limits to investigators for a few more months.
Finally, on April 27, 2005, Agent Clark got another chance to speak with Marjorie. He entered the state correctional institution at Muncie, Pennsylvania, feeling slightly nervous.
Clark had conducted thousands of interviews over the course of his career, but for some reason, Marjorie frightened him. He had seen her erratic, menacing behavior firsthand in front of reporters. Now he braced himself for the worst.
Clark began his interview by complimenting Marjorie's teeth, hoping to appeal to her narcissism. But Marjorie's guard was up. She stood behind her statements in court and insisted she had nothing to do with the Wells case. Instead, she insisted that the plot belonged to Bill.
Marjorie said that Bill had needed the money to make payments on his mother's house, which his sister had wanted to sell. This much was true. Bill had been interested in the robbery because he needed the money for the house. She also claimed that she had been at Barnes & Noble on the day of Brian Wells' death. Another truth. But this was as much as Marjorie was willing to say.
Fortunately, whatever restraint Marjorie possessed in her interviews with Clark, she lacked entirely in prison.
Often, inmates spy on each other in hopes of bringing useful information to officials that can help lighten their own sentences. Marjorie's psychological state and her inherent narcissism made her a gold mine for her peers, most notably 37-year-old Kelly McKella.
In prison, Marjorie developed a special kinship with Kelly. Both women had a history with domestic violence, and Kelly had once aspired to be a police officer. Marjorie hoped she could use Kelly's understanding of police procedure to her benefit, and Kelly agreed.
Marjorie flooded her with information while Kelly took notes on the sly. On June 8, 2005, she brought what she'd learned to Jerry Clark. Marjorie had admitted to her that Jim Roden's murder was indeed tied to the Brian Wells case. Jim had backed out of the plot, and Marjorie had murdered him to ensure his silence.
At last, Clark was vindicated. His suspicions had been correct all along.
Marjorie had also told Kelly that Bill Rothstein built the collar bomb using scraps of metal. She said Brian was supposed to rob the bank and give the money to Floyd Stockton. Marjorie had even admitted to poisoning Brian's co-worker, Robert Panetti.
If this wasn't enough, Kelly's notes alone were horribly incriminating for Marjorie. One said, point blank, "Marge told me that Bill, James, Floyd, and the other pizza guy, and Wells, planned the robbery."
Clark couldn't believe his eyes. This was it. But he still needed more evidence to corroborate the notes and separate Marjorie's gibberish from the truth. And so, he had to pursue the only other living people mentioned in the notes: Floyd Stockton and Ken Barnes.
Coming up, investigators choose which of Brian Wells' conspirators walks free.
Now, back to the story.
In January of 2005, 56-year-old Marjorie Deal Armstrong was sentenced to a maximum of 20 years in prison for the murder of James Roden. Naturally, she rattled off details of Roden's murder to her fellow inmates.
One inmate, Kelly McKella, provided FBI agent Jerry Clark with over 24 pages of notes on Marjorie's confessions. Now, it was up to Clark to secure testimony from the remaining witnesses, Floyd Stockton and Ken Barnes.
In the summer of 2005, Floyd Stockton was still locked away at a correctional facility in Spokane, Washington, serving out a 2-year rape sentence. Twice a day, he placed a call to his girlfriend back home in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Unbeknownst to Floyd, Clark began meeting with his girlfriend in an attempt to tickle the wire. This is a technique where an investigator plants an idea in the mind of someone related to their target. If all goes well, this person will turn around and mention the topic directly to the target.
Clark's maneuvering paid off. Before long, on one of her calls to Floyd, the girlfriend said, "They think the two things are related."
She didn't have to explain what the two things were, and Floyd didn't have to ask. When Clark listened to the tapes of their conversations, he was convinced that Floyd knew more about the Brian Wells case than he'd let on.
On July 19, 2005, Jerry Clark sat across from Floyd in a prison meeting room. For someone who had previously fooled a lie detector test, it didn't take much to get Floyd talking this time around.
When Clark asked why Jim Roden had been killed, Floyd replied that it was because of the collar bomb plot. He said that Marjorie and Bill had concocted the plot because they needed money. After that, he refused to say more, but it was already plenty.
In an effort to foster a relationship with Floyd, Clark hugged him and told him he'd done the right thing. He knew he needed to earn Floyd's trust if he wanted his help in bringing Marjorie to justice.
By the fall of 2005, the district attorney had given Jerry Clark all of the evidence from the Jim Roden murder trial. Among the items was a letter Marjorie had written to the Department of Revenue in 2000. In it, she complained about how the PNC Bank in Erie had handled her deceased mother's safe deposit box. It was the same bank Brian Wells had robbed. Glaring proof of Marjorie's grievances and possible motivations.
In late 2005, Agent Clark turned his attention to another individual who was mentioned in Kelly McKella's notes, 51-year-old Ken Barnes.
Clark was hopeful with this new lead, but he had to proceed carefully to gain Ken's trust. Ken, meanwhile, had had plenty of time in the 2 years since Brian Wells' murder to think of an alibi.
When Clark asked Ken if he knew Brian Wells, Ken said that he didn't, but that he'd heard of his death through a mutual acquaintance, a sex worker named Jessica Hoopsick. Ken said that Brian was one of Jessica's clients.
Clark immediately remembered Jessica's name. It was in a contact book that had been found at Brian Wells' home. Immediately, the pieces fell in place. Jessica was the link from Brian to Ken to Marjorie and Bill.
In another interview, Ken admitted to Clark that Marjorie had approached him about killing her father prior to the Brian Wells robbery. He said she had complained that her father was spending her late mother's money, which she believed was rightfully hers. He said Marjorie had also asked if he knew how to build a bomb with a timer and if he would drive a getaway car.
Ken denied any actual participation, but the information he had given so far was extremely helpful in shoring up Clark's suspicions.
On December 9th, 2005, Ken met with the assistant U.S. attorney, Marshall Pisanini, to prepare for a grand jury hearing. He'd be testifying against Marjorie in the Brian Wells case. Clark was there to watch the interview. At one point, Pisanini mentioned what Marjorie had said about going to Barnes & Noble on the day of Brian's death. He asked Ken if he'd been with Marjorie at the store, and Ken said yes.
Suddenly, a realization hit Clark. This was the first time Ken had linked himself to Marjorie on the day of the robbery, indicating that he had been involved in the case one way or another. The investigators scrambled to bring Ken back to the office for further questioning.
Possibly knowing he'd been cornered, Ken returned to the office and gave a detailed and factual account of what happened before, during, and after the bombing. He told them about Brian's debt to Jessica Hoopsick's drug dealers, which may have motivated Brian to participate in the robbery. He even told them how Bill had built the collar bomb.
Ken had elevated himself from a witness to person of interest, and the FBI's access to him became much easier in March of 2006 when Ken was charged for selling cocaine. If Clark needed Ken, he could simply look him up at the Erie County Prison.
And this wasn't the only advantage to Ken's arrest. After he was taken into custody, his estranged half-brother, Ricky Barnes, stopped by the FBI office in Erie to sign for his brother's wallet. Ricky disliked Ken. He felt he'd mistreated their family, and he had no problem with Ken being in prison. Clark saw an opportunity to capitalize off of this, roping in Ricky as an informant.
Ken told Ricky that Brian had indeed been forced to wear the bomb and that there were no black men involved, as Brian had suggested to the police. Ken also said that all of the bomb-making materials had been dumped at a landfill.
All these facts were filtered back to Agent Clark and his team, who were getting closer and closer to an indictment. They decided to try their hand with Marjorie again.
On May 10th, Marjorie accompanied investigators on a guided tour of her movements on August 28, 2003. She took them to the Eaton Park parking lot and pointed out the exact spot where she had parked that day. It was the same exact place that Barnes had said they watched the robbery from. But then, Marjorie clammed up. She refused to say anything more without immunity.
This was a major consideration throughout the investigation. Who should be given immunity and why? With three key players, Marjorie, Floyd, and Ken still alive, the FBI would have to decide which two fish to fry and which one to cut loose.
It all came down to evidence. By mid-2007, Clark felt a grand jury already had more than enough grounds to indict both Marjorie and Ken. Both had unwittingly talked themselves into incrimination. Marjorie through Kelly's notes and Ken through his own testimony. But while Clark felt there was plenty of evidence against them, the U.S. Attorney's Office was more cautious. They wanted another witness.
And so, Assistant U.S. Attorney Marshall Piccinini turned his attention to Floyd Stockton, who had been released from prison in 2005. Piccinini felt that the evidence against Floyd wasn't enough to indict him, and even if they could, Floyd's involvement in the case seemed less extensive than Marjorie and Ken's. So out of the three, Floyd was the perfect candidate for immunity.
Floyd had already provided details about the events of August 28, 2003, but he seemed to be withholding information for fear of being indicted. So in mid-2007, Piccinini decided to offer Floyd a queen for a day proffer.
This meant that Floyd would be given one day to talk with at least partial immunity. Nothing Floyd told them on that particular day could be directly used against him. His confessions could, however, be used to collect further evidence against him.
On March 27, 2007, Marshal Piccinini and Agent Clark arrived at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Seattle, where they met with Floyd and his lawyer. Over the next 13 hours, Floyd gave them a full account of the events surrounding the bombing. He admitted to giving Bill the idea for a bomb heist. He told them that he himself had suggested the use of a pizza delivery man. In admitting his part in making the collar bomb, Floyd had arguably become an accessory to murder. And by the time they left, Clark wanted to indict him. After all, they hadn't promised full immunity.
But they still needed Floyd as a witness against Marjorie. If they refused to protect him, they risked Floyd recanting his statements, rendering him useless as a witness. And without his testimony, the case against Marjorie and Ken would be severely weakened.
The investigators considered their options and ultimately decided that Marjorie and Ken were more important suspects than Floyd. So on June 26, 2007, Floyd Stockton testified before the grand jury with full immunity.
2 weeks later, on July 9th, the grand jury finally secured indictments against Marjorie and Ken. They were charged with the same three felonies: conspiracy to commit armed robbery, aiding and abetting an armed bank robbery involving a death, and aiding and abetting the use of a destructive device in a crime of violence.
Ken Barnes pleaded guilty to two of the three charges. In return, the third charge was dropped. And on December 3, 2008, a judge sentenced him to 45 years in prison. For the 55-year-old Ken, it meant he'd probably be spending the rest of his life behind bars.
The trial of Marjorie Deal Armstrong wouldn't come to a close for almost two more years. But on November 1st, 2010, the jury announced their verdict: guilty on all three charges. Marjorie, who passionately maintained her innocence until the bitter end, was sentenced to life in prison.
Over 7 years had passed since Brian Wells' death, and the case had finally come to a conclusion. Agent Jerry Clark would later state that the crime couldn't be explained by any rationale because the two main conspirators, Marjorie and Bill Rothstein, were devoid of it. According to Clark, Marjorie's mental problems and narcissism had blinded her to the pitfalls of the plan, and that Bill didn't even care if they succeeded or failed. He knew he was dying. To him, it was all a game, and he was willing to sacrifice anything, even innocent lives, for the sake of winning. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage.
You can find all of our Parcast originals for free on Spotify. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Juan Borda, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Isabella Way. This episode of Hostage was written by Natalie McKieran, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.